I'm going to actually call the meeting, first meeting of the Jobs and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee to order.
Okay. Thought I was loud enough as it was. I want to welcome everybody here. This is a committee that there's some things we'll go over, but before we go over that, for those that are new to the committee, President Gunther was the chair the previous 2 years and at a time before that. Representative Gunther went out of his way to be bipartisan. There's a reason a lot of people call him Uncle Bob. I'm not one of them, but we're about close to, too close to the same age. And I'm going to try and do the same thing. I think I've told a couple of people that jobs and economic development, I mean, government, my philosophy, government doesn't create jobs. We, and particularly in this committee, we don't create jobs. We set the table. We set the table for the industry in the state of Minnesota to do a better job of creating a healthier economy. And sometimes, the longer you take to set the table, the more entertaining the dinner is. And you get it right. I can go on a lot and tell you more of my philosophy. I hope to do that. I think you've all gotten an email that I'm happy to sit down and meet with people. I would like to do that to find out what your wants are out of this committee. I particularly said that first statement about not creating jobs and setting the table because there's been a lot of churn through this committee, and I think it's because a lot of people think that they come to this committee and they'll be able to claim that they created 100,000 jobs the next biennium. And again, if we do it right, the economy of Minnesota will grow on its own. We can do public-private partnerships. We can have the Department of Labor, the Department of Deed, provide to our employers in the state good services. Most of our big Fortune 500s don't need our services. They do take advantage of a few. But it's the smaller companies under 500 employees that I will try to focus on. So having said that, I'm going to ask, well, I'm Representative Tim Mahoney, and I represent the northeast corner of the city of St. Paul. I'm not going to ask for a long recitation about where you're from and why you're here, because you've probably done it already in another committee. So if I could just start to my right with the lead. We'll get the staff at the end of the members.
I'm Representative Bob Gunther. I come from southern Minnesota, you all, and Fairmont, Minnesota is my hometown.
I'm Representative Mark Uglum, 36A, Champlin and part of Coon Rapids. I'm the former mayor over there in Champlin and a retired business guy.
Tony Albright for Scott County, Middle Third of Scott County, Jordan, Prior Lake.
Dan Fabian, House District 1A, which is the furthest northwest corner of Minnesota. Kitson, Roseau, Marshall, and part of Pennington County.
Hi, I'm Ernie Leidiger, and I represent western Carver County. Carver County is located to the southwest of the Lake Minnetonka. We've got towns of Victoria, and Watertown, and Waconia, Cologne, and Homburg, and Norwood Young America.
I'm Representative Kathy Lohmer. I represent District 39B, which is Stillwater, not all of Stillwater, part of Stillwater, pretty much the East Metro along the river from just north of Afton up through Grant and Lake Elmo. I have 12 communities that I represent.
I guess this one. Kim Norton, I represent Rochester in the county of Olmsted.
Jason Metza, I represent 6B, east side of the Iron Range.
Jerry Newton, I represent the northern suburbs or portion of them of Coon Rapids, Blaine, and Spring Lake Park.
Karen Clark. I represent three inner-city neighborhoods in South Minneapolis and a part of the fourth.
John Ward. I represent Crow Wing County up in the Brainerd-Pequot Lakes area.
Jason Isaacson, 42B, Roseville, Shoreview, Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, and Gem Lake.
Andrea Kiefer, represent most of Woodbury, and I'm honored to be on this committee again with you guys.
John Purcell, House District 5A, North Central Minnesota. When Representative Fabian gets up to my home around Cass Lake, he's halfway to his.
thank you, members. I'm going to with Mr. Sullivan over there, and we'll just go right around the table and introduce staff.
I'm David Sullivan with DFL Research. I staff this committee as well as Ways and Means, and I staffed it the last 2 years when Representative Gunther was the chair.
Hi, I'm Kaying Tao, and I'm the LA to Representative Mahoney and Representative Mason.
Hello, everybody. My name is Abu Amara. I'm the CA for this committee as well as housing, and yeah.
I'm Anita Newman. I'm from House Research, and I staff this committee and the Labor, Workforce, and Regulated Industry Committee.
I'm John Reynolds. I'm the researcher for the Republican Caucus. I staff this as well as Commerce, Housing, and Regulated Industries.
I'm Ron Soderberg with House Fiscal.
And our page?
I'm Anita Nassir, and I'll be on this committee and Jobs Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I think in your package you probably found the committee expectations. I didn't realize that was the heading. But the committee, kind of the committee rules. This has been a fairly fluid committee. We've not had real stringent rules. There's a 24-hour rule, primarily more for staff than for me, in the terms that the staff have to get copies of the amendments and all the paperwork into the files. If you talk to me, I'm not going to try and stifle anyone, but I will tell you, I'll probably tell you, you're going to have to bring your own 50 copies of your amendment if you're writing it up a half hour before committee, because the staff probably won't be able to get it done. Let's see, where else? Oh, yes, and then number 9. It's one of the things that I have been buttonholed and upgraded a number of times. We have a lot of government professionals here. I am not as worried about them, although I do like most of them. I'm asking that the members not bring their computers, not read newspapers, do correspondence. Let's be respectful. People sometimes come a long ways or short ways. There are constituents. They have, this is their one chance to, maybe their one and only chance to be heard in front of their government. And I believe, and I've been told pretty clearly by some of the witnesses, that we sometimes don't do as good a job as we should. So I will, although I won't stop the committee, you might get a little note from one of delivered by the page that, you know, should put your correspondence away if you're doing it, because I think our witnesses deserve our attention. Other than that, do we have any, am I missing anything else? It's good to have good staff.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the laptops, on occasion, in anticipation of a meeting, I've put some documents or have some information that may be helpful to me during things that we're doing. So, I mean, is there any flexibility in that rule? Thank you.
Again, I'm not the, we're adults here. I'm not a babysitter. I expect you to, if you bring your laptop to relatively discreet, but not sit there and work on it for an hour and a half while somebody's testifying. If you're looking up a document, of course, I've been on a couple of committees where my neighbor had their laptop out and it kept moving over into the space that I have, and you know, my East Side manners almost overcame my sensibilities. Just be forewarned. Any other questions of the chair?
Sure. One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Just with regards to the amendments, will they be distributed before our meetings?
Most amendments should be either distributed. They'll be distributed in our packets or here. Hopefully, we can get them posted online prior to the committee hearing, particularly if they are within 24. If you meet the 24-hour rules, because again, staff should be able to get them up and online now. And it is always good to, as Representative Gunter will remind anybody, I've been known to read the bills every once in a while.
Bummed me out.
and I recommend it to anyone else. I will say this, if you've got a bill that you're bringing through this committee, it will get heard. You're a member of this committee, I will hear your bills. I may not vote for them, but I'll hear your bills. And we'll see where we can go with them. If they need to go to another committee, I'm not going to hold up committee members' bills unless it's completely off a deep end, like it's spending $1 billion. I might hold that one up. So, well, unless there's other questions? Seeing none, who's first on the agenda? The Department of Labor and Industry. We're going to have a few overviews here. This will be the start of them. I would expect for the next couple of weeks we'll have a few overviews and hopefully start hearing bills. It's almost the middle of January already, so closer towards the end. Welcome, Commissioner. Introduce yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members, for the opportunity to come before you and talk about my department. I'm going to be a few people with me. I won't introduce them all, but I do want to point out our legislative liaison person, John Rakowski. John's right here. Raise your hand, John. So if you have a constituent problem or another problem with the department or question an issue, please feel free to call me or to call John or contact him and to take care of your stuff. John's phone number is
cell number, right?
Cell number 651-503-4592. My cell phone number is 651-210-5239. So if you have a question, call one of us and we'll try to take care of it as quickly as we can.
And I think for members of the committee that have been around, both are relatively responsive, very good at it. Representative
Chair, I just think if he could repeat those numbers, it was a little too fast.
Yeah, that was the idea, Representative Clark.
I know.
John's number is 651-503-4592. Thank you. And my number is 651-210-5239. I almost forgot it there. Once again, thank you, members. Appreciate the time. The Department of Labor and Industry is first. We didn't have a chance to really put together a well-developed overview. So we did pass out in your packet is this document, which I'll be bouncing around from. I don't think you'll get a lot from just trying to follow me because you won't be able to. But I will be referring to this on again, off again through my presentation. Labor industry is first and foremost a regulatory agency. In the construction area, we like to say we regulate everything behind the walls, under the floors, and above the ceilings. We also regulate workplace safety, ensure proper reimbursement medical care for workplace injuries, oversee on-the-job training, and finally, in the newest addition to our department, in our Office of Combative Sports, make sure the participants in professional boxing and mixed martial arts are safe. I'm not going to go through. And for any of you members who would like to take up boxing or mixed martial arts, we encourage it. That was a bad joke. I'm not going to go through our individual budget at all today, but I'll just hit on some of it because we'll go through the budget in more detail after the governor makes his budget presentation next week, and I presume sometime in the weeks after that we'll have an opportunity to go through that. But we'll touch on some of the budget information for you to help you get a better idea of how our department operates. On this document here, on the upper left-hand corner, we have a number of just data that we use. We're trying to use a lot, like other agencies in state government, we're using a lot more performance measurements. But these are just some of the numbers that we sometimes use that we look at to determine how we're doing. So I'll just give a quickly go through those. The first one's 85%. That's percentage of mediated workers' compensation cases resolved by labor industry mediators. We have a group of mediators who are former district court judges, lawyers, and others that help mediate. Our $50 million, the next figure, that's paid annually for second injury and supplemental benefits. Those are two workers' comp benefits that were done away with in the mid-90s, but we're still paying. I'll go into much more detail on that a little later. We're still paying on those injuries that were incurred prior to 1995. OSHA workplace inspections, 2,600 a year, and workplace safety consultations, 1,700. As I'll describe in a minute, we have OSHA compliance and OSHA consultation. Compliance is the ones that you hear about the most. They're the ones who go out and inspect the work site and then may give penalties or fines because of some dangers on the work site. Consultation is a free service that we try to provide mostly to small business, but to others, to any employer who wants to have someone come in and just give advice on how to make their workplace a safer place. That's free for anybody, and there's no contact between consultation and compliance. 20,000 is the next number. It's the annual number of inquiries regarding wage and hour laws. 17,000 of those are phone calls, and 3,000 are emails. It's just people calling up saying the boss didn't pay them, or calling about asking about overtime, child labor, minimum wage, that sort of thing. We often find ourselves trying to mediate with an employer who hasn't paid someone, and you have to pay within 30 days. We call the call the employer and say, is this individual employee of yours? And if so, you have to pay them, and we give them the law. Generally, people pay up. Occasionally, they don't, and then we encourage people to go to small claims court and collect. The next number is registered apprentices supported by the department. That's 6,500. Apprenticeships, I think you're all probably somewhat familiar with it. I think it's one of the most underrated programs we have throughout the country, not only just in Minnesota. It's a way of on-the-job learning of mostly it's in the construction industry, but also in some other areas. That it's a great way of learning, and would like to expand that as much as possible. Some of you may be familiar with the country of Germany has something like 200 different occupations you have to go through an apprenticeship program to be a practitioner, and that seems to have served their economy very well over the years. Maybe someday we'll do that thing. We'll do that something similar in the United States. 125,000. The next ones, individuals and businesses licensed in construction-related activities. In 2005, Governor Pawlenty joined the various construction-related trades, the regulation in one department from the electrical board, the plumbing board, high-pressure piping, and boilers and elevators. They put them all in our department. And we do issue 125,000 licenses every year. We're doing that more and more electronically, and we're very, very happy with that. That seems to be working pretty successfully. 225,000 is the next number, is number of electrical inspections performed annually. That we do a lot of electrical inspections. Some are done by some municipalities like the City of Minneapolis, some others, but we do most of them throughout the state. Generally, you do two. If you have a home, you get two electrical inspections. One is before you put in the walls and sort of the rough in, and then you do a final inspection. A lot of our inspections are done, which I'll explain, I might as well explain it now. We hire people, contract electrical inspectors, about 75 of them, who do most of our electrical inspectors. We have a few of our own, 5 to 10, who work, but the others are on contract. That allows us, in times like in the period of 2008 to 2010, during economic downturns, we don't have to lay people off. Instead, we just cut back on the work that those individuals do. So they're entrepreneurs, and some have their own electrical contracting business, and others don't. And but they are responsible for doing the electrical inspections we ask them to do. And we think that's been a pretty good system. Now I'll go through in more detail about some of the parts of the department. Now, workers' comp was, you probably all know, workers' comp was set up, I don't know if you know this part, workers' comp was set up 100 years ago. This is the 100th anniversary of workers' compensation in Minnesota. And basically what it is, it's an agreement between, at that time it was the legislative agreement, it's been ongoing to be an agreement between management on the one hand, employees on the other hand. Management, or employees give up the right to sue for personal injuries in district court. And on the other hand, employers promise that they will provide workers' comp insurance and provide for medical care and indemnity benefits, wage loss benefits to injured workers. And so just that's the arrangement, and that's in most cases you do go through the workers' compensation system. We do have, in terms of workers' compensation legislation, we have the legislature set up a workers' compensation advisory committee, which several members of this committee sat on, that is composed of management and labor, and all bills that on workers' comp that come to the legislature have to go through that. And that way it keeps this highly, this can be a highly volatile issue. And it just is able to kind of sort it out, to screen it out, to filter it out, to work out any compromise that need to be worked out beforehand. Or if one side doesn't want it and the other side does, it just won't get to you. And I think the system's worked pretty well. We've got a pretty good work comp system in our state. We have several responsibilities with the workers' comp system. We keep the records, we ensure compliance with the laws, provide alternative dispute resolutions, provide benefits to employees of uninsured employers. That is, if you, you're working for somebody, turns out you get hurt and they're uninsured, then we provide benefits to you. And also pay second injury and supplementary benefits. Those are the ones that I mentioned earlier that they did away with them in 1995 or 96, but we're still paying for those injuries incurred before then. We also, in some cases, provide voc rehab to workers to help injured workers get back to work. We have about 30,000 reported injuries, workplace injuries a year. That number has gone down, even though we're growing a population. In part, that's because of the changing type of work we do, less manufacturing, that sort of thing. But in part, I think it's also increased safety consciousness. I'd like to say some of this part due to OSHA, but a lot of companies think it's a pain in the neck to have to retrain their people if they get hurt. And so we have a lot more safety professionals with a lot more people that are very conscious of safety on the job. And so we are seeing fewer injuries. But about 30,000, we call them first reports of injuries, about 6,000, 20% end up in disputes. And those are the ones you hear about where the insurance company or the employer refuses to pay for one part or another, and then you go through the dispute system. And we try to settle out as many as we can so to speed up the system. But for some cases, it can take 2 to 3 years, or somebody could be injured and then have a medical bill 10 years later or has to go through a dispute. That's it's a complicated system, but when we try to make as many steps possible to make it run as smoothly for all sides, to make it work as smoothly as possible. If we can't resolve them, they're decided by the Office of Administrative Hearings in a hearing, and then it goes to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals and ultimately to the State Supreme Court. Like I said, the trend is fewer injuries, but we're seeing more disputes, a higher percentage of cases ending up in disputes, and a higher cost per claims. The reason for the higher cost per claim, I think, is just basically higher medical costs. They've been going up as every place else, and workers' comp and every place else. We just had a session this morning with the Workers' Compensation Research Institute, and they said that our medical costs have kind of increased and moderated in the last several years, but they were going up 5 or 10% per year. In the last several years, they've gone evened out, and we're not quite sure what the reason is. It could have been because of the recession. Some people just simply weren't reporting their injuries. They weren't going to the docs. They're afraid of losing their jobs. But it could be that the providers were modifying their bills, too. We're not quite sure what the reason is, but the costs, we're glad to see the cost moderating some. The total cost of the workers' comp system per year is about $1.4 billion. The expenses can be divided in three ways. 35% goes to medical costs, 31% to administrative costs for the insurers, 30% for indemnity payments, and about 2% for rehab. That's roughly. The division has 125 full-time employees. We have our performance measure we're using there comes from the Wage Loss Work Loss Institute from Texas and California. They have five different outcome measures. numbers of injuries, cases missing work, median disability durations, delayed recovery rate in key conditions, and low back strains. But us, Minnesota, along with Utah and Arizona, is given an A-plus by this group. We're the three top states in the union, just in terms of the overall performance of our workers' comp system. So obviously we like that rating system, but it does seem to reflect. I think it works pretty well. For some individuals, it doesn't work so well. We know that. But I think overall, the system's working reasonably well. Minnesota OSHA is set up to prevent injuries. You're probably all familiar with it. It's set up in 1970, I think, was passed, 1971. And we have what's called a state plan. About 25 other states have state plans, too. That is that we operate the OSHA ourselves, as opposed to having the federal government. So the federal government pays 50% of our compliance efforts and 90% of our consultation efforts. And the state, we take it out of the workers' comp fund, pays for the state portion. That allows us to have more people, more inspectors, and we hopefully do a better job than other states. We think that we're very proud of our OSHA, some of the leadership it's shown over the years. We were the first ones to pass it. This is Representative Clark's did years ago, not that many years ago, but the Toxic Substances Right to Know Act. Last year we were the first, we had just a rash of window washer accidents. We're leading the country in window washer deaths. We had three people die in 4 years, and so we passed, which is a sort of a, when I first brought it up, people were surprised, but you talk to the family, it's a big deal. But we did pass some new requirements for new buildings and other requirements for training for window washers. And right now we're doing stuff on cranes, safe patient handling. It's always been one of the chief areas of work comp growth has become in nursing homes, lifting patients, and so we're trying to encourage people. We have a conference every year that's just devoted to safe patient handling. After there's terrible shootings in Minneapolis last fall, I forget the name of the workplace, where the five or six people were killed, we had a number of sessions of workplace violence and tried to be out there and tell people about workplace violence. We'll be doing more on that, trying to prevent that terrible thing from happening. Our performance measures there, we've reduced, there's been a reduction in the last 2 years of our fatality rates. We lose around 20 to 25 people a year. We've dropped that by 25% in the last 2 years. And so hopefully we'll be able to keep going down. But fatalities are something that just, the weird things happen. It's sort of like a homicide. You can't necessarily predict it. We do have a large percent of consultation with small employers, 96%. Too many of our fatalities happen with small employers who really don't know what they're are as careful as a larger employer might be. So we do want to get out there and talk to them, as many of them as possible. Our next, if you have questions, please ask me. I'm just rolling through this stuff, but please, if you got a question, please, Mr. Chairman.
Do you think the governor's going to file a low back workers' comp?
We'll fight it. we don't want any malingering. Labor standards, another section we have. That's our only section that's funded through the general fund. Most of our sections I'll go through later are funded by various fees and stuff. And that section enforces state laws regarding child labor, minimum wage, overtime, employee rights, regarding termination and wages due. Like I said earlier, we got about 20,000 inquiries a year there and try to work with people as much as possible. We don't go out and necessarily independently enforce it. We couldn't enforce all the violations. So we tell people there is a problem. The best we coach them on how to go to conciliation court, how to bring an action, and then if they've got a wage claim, they can do that. We think that's a better way. If we were to start enforcing it ourselves, would be working on 15 or 20 claims a year, not really be able to enforce much. So that's the approach we think has worked much better. We also do a lot of educational outreach to employers, industry groups, community-based groups, and that sort of thing. And that group also puts together prevailing wage information every 2 years, setting the different classifications and that sort of thing. That group served last year 63,000 employees and recovered $1.9 million in back wages for people. It's one of our performance measures. Apprenticeship, as I said earlier, fosters on-the-job training programs. It's mostly in the construction industry, but also in other places. I think it's a great program. I wish that somehow we could really expand it, and I'm not quite sure how. I beat this drum, but No one seems to be listening, so I'm not sure what happened. But it's a good program, and we've got six people working there. And they basically follow the Federal Apprenticeship Act, and we start work on apprenticeship programs and register and make sure that people take it through completion, usually 2 to 4 years. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I noticed on the bottom there it says that the current percentage of the registered apprentices are men and women, women and minorities is 24%.
Yeah.
Two questions, and you alluded to one of them already a little bit. What does that look like, say, in the last decade? 10 years ago, what did that percent look like? And then moving forward then, how do you get, or are you doing anything to increase that number from 24% to 35%, 50%?
The number's gone up considerably over the last 10 years. In part, it's in large part is a reflection of society, that as you get more and more, it's become more and more diverse society, you get more and more people enrolled in it. There's no question about that. And one of the things about apprenticeship, I'll answer the other part of your question, but one thing about apprenticeship, a lot of people go into it, into construction, and they find out it doesn't work for them. So we have about a 50% drop-off from people to start to people to finish. It's a tough job. Working on a day like today, wouldn't be much fun.
It's lovely out there today if you're working outside.
Spoken like a true pipe there. But in terms of, we are making an effort, Representative Ward, to increase those numbers. We're asking each apprenticeship program to give us a plan of action, how they want to increase it, how they'll get more women and more racial minorities involved in the program. At the same time, we're not interested in trying to force other people out of the programs either, but we do think we need to encourage more people to be in it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that Ken was taking over the chair by calling on people directly. But I had a question. Did you say that you, when people call about a wage violation, you usually refer them to take civil action?
We, Representative Mulray, Mr. Chair, what we try to do is we call, we'll assume you call up, and we'll say, Representative Mulray, we will call your employer on your behalf, and we'll talk to her or him and try to find out what they're saying. We call them and ask us to send us information about it. Usually they'll right away in the call, they'll say, oh, we forgot, we'll pay. But if they don't pay, we try to get them information, then let them know that they are in violation of the law. But then if they still refuse to pay, say they assert that the individual's, that you're not an employee, that you're in fact a part owner, or you never were there, then we instruct them to go into conciliation court. Because we simply can't, we have so many calls, we don't have enough people to spend their time going after trying to enforce. And to enforce it, we'd have to get a court order, use the Attorney General's office to get a court order, and then get the court order telling the employer to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little concerned about, more than a little concerned about that we're not doing more to help them. And that would, does that also apply to large number? I know that, for instance, prevailing wage, there's often quite a bit of it going on a project. And so is that the same there? But then my next question is, when violations are found, how many times have there been a penalty assessed, number one? How many times have there been debarments, and then how many times have there been, not the penalties, but the, I think under the statute, and I can't remember if it's double or triple. Basically, the problem is that an employer, if they don't face a penalty for it, what's the downside of doing it? If all I have to, if I don't pay Ron, he's working for me. What is the incentive for me to do it if all I have to do is pay him anyhow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, members, there are two different issues here. The prevailing wage is dealt with differently than the typical single wage claim. If someone does come in with a whole bunch of them, we'll certainly take action. If with one employer is refusing to pay or properly pay a group of his employees, or say ignoring break laws and that sort of thing, we will take action. If it's an entire group of people, but for individuals, it's just simply too hard for us. We simply don't have the person power to follow up on every wage claim. On prevailing wage, though, we will. We do take actions there and force them to pay. In terms of debarments, I don't think we've had one debarment last year. Debarment members means that an individual contractor with the state is unable to contract with the state because of the failure to pay prevailing wage. Debarment is obviously the last step, a drastic step to take. So we don't like doing that, but if someone is consistently not paying, we'll debar them.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on, he didn't answer the two questions about the penalties. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. But,
about the penalties and
this is Jessica Lumen, Assistant Commissioner. She's more familiar with the penalties.
Penalties.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, or identify yourself for the record, and give Mr. Representative Mulley some answers.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jessica Lumen. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry, and I oversee the Labor Standards Division. To try to answer your questions, and just to clarify a couple of points, we really process three different kinds of claims in the Labor Standards Division. We process wage claims, which are under 181, 13, and 14, and those are basically the way we look at them as final wages. Thank you. And we processed about 1,000 of those last year, and about 50% of the time we can get the employer to pay. If there is a dispute about how much is owed for the last paycheck, that's when we have to refer the individuals to conciliation court. And many of them are successful pursuing their claims there. We also, so that's the one kind, is the final wages. We also do lots of labor standards investigations, and those are overtime, child labor, minimum wage violations, tip issues. And we conducted about 400 of those last year. And we're able to complete and close about 400 of those cases last year. And then the third type is prevailing wage enforcement cases. And we did about 200 of those last year, closed 200 cases of those. So those are the overarching sort of scope of the work that we do in that division. To answer your question about penalties, I don't have right now the number of penalties that were assessed in those three types of claims, but we did collect about $92,000 in penalties. Which would go to the general fund for labor standards and prevailing wage violations last year.
Thank you, Ms. Moon. I will take the prerogative of the chair and recommend to the commissioner that you find somebody in the committee that would be interested in working on a manufacturer's apprenticeship program.
We'll work with Representative Norton. He's a very bright person.
Very bright
individual
person.
Individual and hardworking legislator.
There you go. And we have about 15 minutes left allotted for your time, so if you could proceed.
Construction code licensing is the next unit. It's the single biggest unit we have. It oversees construction activities in several areas. It licenses electricians, plumbers, high-pressure piping, boiler operators, elevator installers, and building contractors. And as I said earlier, about 125,000 licenses done every 2 years. We also inspect elevators, electrical installations, plumbing, high-pressure piping, and review plans for new public buildings. And then also, this division puts together new construction codes, working with the models put out by the national code associations. Right now, we'll be completing them within a year, working on a new residential and commercial construction codes, a new energy code, and a new accessibility code. Those will be based on the 2012 codes released by the national code associations. And there we work with a variety of of individual citizens. I think well over 100 people have been meeting with us on various committees and trying to work through what the right things, the wrong things for us to do. We try to make as Minnesota specific as we can, but also recognizing the need for companies that operate between the various states to have a single code. That say you're a Target, you like to have only one code to work with, and so we try to combine those two issues all the time.
And if I might, to the committee, most of the code work is done. About 8-10 years ago, we put together the whole system pushing, because we used to do codes on the House floor. And I'm not sure if most people wanted a lawyer or a teacher or a pipe fitter making codes, but it's better to have professionals do it than you and I most of the time. Representative Gunther.
We had a pipe fitter, and you did a pretty good job.
Thank you.
We made a big effort in this division under Jessica's leadership to increase our electronic usages. And so now we 50% of all electrical permits are issued online. And
Commissioner, did you have a question, Representative Mulley?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to know, wondered if you understood the great compliment you had, because Representative Gunther just praised a pipe fitter and his father-in-law is a plumber.
I understood. Thank you.
And 25% of our licenses are now renewed online, so we're very happy with that. We see that number growing. I think we said that 85% of all plumbers are renewing their licenses online. Electricians are around 60%.
What was that with the electricians again?
About 60%. Our final division that just one that just brought to us, given to us last year, is the Office of Combative Sports. Prior to that time, there was a state combative sports commission that oversees mixed martial arts and boxing. And this is a pretty small division. We've got one full-time employee as well as a number of part-time inspectors. But basically, the idea is to ensure the safety of combatants in boxing, in professional boxing, and in mixed martial arts. And I think we got a great staff, people with lots of volunteers, spent a lot of time on this. It's an important thing to a number of people, so we want to run it as well as we possibly can.
Commissioner, you said you have one full-time employee?
Yes, one full-time employee, as well as a number of part-time employees. So the number there is inflated because we have a number of 5% employees. We call them inspectors. They're the people that go out at the matches that may wrap, that oversee the wrapping of the knuckles and making sure there's no cheating going on, that no one's putting something inside the gloves or something like that.
Representative Gunther.
I feel compelled to say I'm sorry, but I've heard nothing but wonderful things with the job that Labor and Industry is doing with the Combative Sports Commission. If I ever was worried about the safety of those people, I'm not nearly as worried as I was before.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, thank you very much. I appreciate that comment.
Representative Mehta.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know my predecessor told you not to let me talk, but I have a good question.
He did so much that you don't really need to say much for a couple of years.
The ripples are still out there. Commissioner Peterson, I was just wondering if we have partnerships with the organization in the apprenticeship program or with our trades unions who are often specializing in some of these already.
A lot of partnerships, both with unions as well as with individual employers. That they work out very well. And we certainly... We're looking for more.
Great, thank you.
The final division is the general support division. We've got 50-some people working in there. And the current budget, I guess, I think it's right, is that the people that do work in information technology are still under our budget, but as of next year, they'll go with the Office of Information Technology. Mm-hmm. So we've got 15 or 16 people that do computer stuff, phone stuff, that sort of thing. And they'll be going to the agency they call Minute, I believe, next year. But this year, I think they will be under our budget. And our general support, they do human resources, counting, that sort of thing. Now I want to just, if that's okay, I'd like to just quickly go through some of the money stuff.
Please.
Look at that first page. In this page right here, source of funds. There's a circle. You see, workers' compensation, 71%. That comes from an assessment that's been going down the last 15 or 20 years, assessment that the commissioner makes every fall on that goes against the on everybody's premium that they pay for that, and that pays for the second injuries that I discussed, the supplementary benefits, as well as the operations of the workers' comp system in the state. About 50% of that, or about two-thirds of that 71% goes to basically the benefits. And those benefits, that'll eventually end, I suppose, by if you're you're here in 2040, there'll probably be very few of those being paid at that time because the people will simply be no longer eligible, being too old for it. The next part is 19% for the workers' comp also pays for OSHA, too. But construction code's 19%. Those are basically fees for licenses and permits that we get. That number goes up and down with the construction economy. Several years ago, we had to lay off a whole number of people. But now, as the construction economy has picked up, we're getting more money in there and more greater demands on our services. We've hired a few people back. Federal funds, 4%. That's basically OSHA. Special revenue, the general funds less than 1%, that goes for labor standards. And special revenue funds are things like, we've got a program called LogSafe that goes for loggers and construction safety fund that goes, that's used for contract recovery fund for contractors who aren't unable to pay a judgment against them. And so those are funds that basically go into us and then go back out that we have no control over. You can look just at the two expenditures by program right beside there. It might be more interesting to look at we have a limited amount of time to go on the last page. This will just quickly go through the difference, the external money and the internal money that we spend in the department. That's this thing right here. Going across the top, you see Department of Labor and Industry Agency total. You'll see salary, then operations, and the 458 FDEs. The total number, the total budget there in 2014 will be around $50 million. But the external budget will be $92 million. So the total amount of expenditures will be $143. So it costs $50 to run labor and industry, but we have the other $92 million comes in and out of the department for various reasons. I'll explain in a minute. Then if you look at the next one below that is the information technology budget, which is $3.9 million. So you subtract that because that really is part of a minute, and so we get $46 million. And you'll see the percentage of expenditures there that's under the total line is 32.7% goes for internal operations, 64% go to external. Quickly going through the external things we spend money on. The first one is called Vinland. Vinland is, I don't think it's Representative Leiter. I don't think it's in your district, but it's next to you, I think, in the Western Hennepin County in Loretto. That it's Vinland's rehabilitation place that we have a contract with, that they take the most severe rehab cases, and we pay them up to $200,000 a year. And if they have no cases, they don't get any money. And so it's just run that way. The special comp fund unit, the next one, benefit claims for injured workers. This is the one I talked about before. These are the payments that go for supplementary benefits and for second injury benefits, $70 million. Other state agencies are also funded out of the work comp fund. 1.7 goes to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. That's a 5-judge panel. Office administrative hearing, 7.2. I think they've got something like 15 to 20 workers' comp judges there. I'm not sure how many. The Commerce Department for fraud investigations gets $751,000, and MMB, because they have all the power, they get $100,000. Just we pay them dues every year. I'm not quite sure. I'm kidding. I'm not quite sure why we pay them that. That goes to their operations.
We'll overhead pass costs. That along to MMB.
Yeah. We behave. OSHA safety consultation. We have safety grants that we pay out for $998,000. This is a program which I'd encourage, if you have anybody in your district want to take advantage of it, then you get up to $10,000 for a safety thing, like for a nursing home or something like that that wants to buy a new lift machine or something. We give out a lot of those. And then the loggers rebate, For those of you in areas, we have loggers. This was set up about 20-some years ago, and it's basically it's a assessment against the mills that goes to provide safety training for loggers, people working in the woods. And it's enabled them to drop their workers' comp rates considerably. It's been a very successful program. I think it's one. It's a typical of an industry. We're the go-between, but it's basically been an industry that's really taken care of its own workers' comp issues over the years. It's been very successful, we think. Contract Recovery Fund is an assessment paid by contractors, $2.5 million. The 76 contract electrical inspectors, $7.5 million. I discussed them earlier, the LEAP grants. These are grants that go to three different groups get them. One, the Minneapolis Urban League. The second is Goodwill Easter Seal. And the third is the Build Minnesota Youth Group. They're basically trying to attract people, women and minorities, into the construction trades. And those are our expenditures of $92 million. And that completes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Are there any questions? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions. The first, you referred to the Vinland grant.
Yeah.
And there's 200 set aside for that, and I carried that grant or that bill a number of years ago. So you said if you don't send people there, you don't pay for it. What happens to the money that's not spent?
Just goes forward the next year, goes back in the workers' compensation fund, and you reappropriate it. Not going to the general fund because it's coming out of the workers' compensation special comp fund, so it just goes back in that fund.
And can you tell me approximately how many people do you know? How many people historically you've been, or how much you've been spending? If you don't know numbers of people,
most years they hit 200,000.
Okay.
Last year I think it was 180. I met with them recently, and they were still at about 80 for this year. So it's going to vary widely, I think, from year to year. But most years they do hit it.
Mr. Chair, I had one other question. Okay, thank you. And this is naivety on my part, and I apologize, but the state does electrical inspections. There are lots of inspections that go into, so what are you inspecting? Everything around the state, and if so, are there other, it seems like there should be more inspections occurring in buildings than just electrical. Why the state on this one?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Peterson.
Norton, I think it could just be a historical accident that we've done. We've always had a strong electrical system, electrical board, and so we've done more inspections than other areas. I don't think there's any particular, I'm not sure, but I don't think there's any particular reason for that. I just think it's a historical accident. The states end up more in the electrical business and not so much in some of the other building code areas.
Mr. Chair.
And there's some, but I want to be clear, like City of Minneapolis does their own, a number of states, number of cities do their own. A number of suburbs and other communities throughout greater Minnesota do their own.
Representative Norton, just a minute. I believe it's cities of the first class have the ability to petition to do their own, and many of them do, but you have to be a city of the first class?
No.
No?
No. So as long as you have the capacity to do it.
Okay. Representative Norton.
Well, I guess, I mean, this is interesting that the state does this one inspection, and I guess I just wonder if there's been discussion. Is there any, as we always are looking at savings, is there any savings or any, has there been any look at decentralizing this particular area and behaving more like some of the other industry inspectors?
I don't think it necessarily be any savings, just if they're charged the same rate we were. There's no tax dollars going into this. It's just the assessment, the what you pay for their permit, and you get someone to come out there. It's certainly, after the shutdown, there were a number of communities that opted to do their own electrical inspections. I can say that. Since then, we haven't had too many since, say, October of last year. But we did, a number of them did opt to do their own inspections after that. I'm not sure there would be any savings. It sort of depends on the individual community. If they think they can do it cheaper than us, I would think they would. And it means they have to, but they have to go through all the business of finding somebody to do it, supervising that person, and then doing the permits. And it's a lot of monkey business they may not want to be involved with.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just follow up a little bit on that. Did these inspectors operate as as state employees or contractors, or what is that status?
They're empowered with the power. They have the power of the state, but they're independent contractors. Now we do have about 10 that work for us too. That do a number of them, but most of them are done by independent contractors. So we negotiate the rate out with them every year or every 2 years.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Norton. I represent a city, Champlin. During the shutdown, Champlin did hire their own electrical inspection team. Seems to have worked out very well. State was doing a good job, but we were able to respond a little quicker. And cost-wise, it was quite economical. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Help me out. I pronounce your last name.
Uglum. Long U, sir.
Thank you, Representative Uglum. Just as an aside from the committee chair that has been following this, anyone who wants to try to expand statewide inspection should talk to the League of Cities and their bankers.
Yeah.
A bit of a cash cow for cities. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Could you explain for me the process of a consultation when you go out and do a consultation for a business?
Yeah.
And then what happens if you find a violation during that time, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, first of all, to answer the last part of your question first, there's no contact between consultation and compliance unless there is imminent safety threat that someone's going to be killed within, by something. So there's really no contact. What they'll do, they'll go out there and take a look at, just call us up, and then we'll send someone there. We have people in all parts of the state, and we'll send someone to the individual work site, and they'll go through the work site and just provide just sort of a checklist of this. You got this problem, you got this problem, and tell them what needs to be done so they could be in compliance with OSHA standards. But there's no contact. This is the biggest thing. People are always, not always. Some people are concerned that they're going to be reported. They won't be reported. They have. It's almost two different cultures that we have in our department in the OSHA section. They have one group that's very devoted to kind of enforcement, but another group is very devoted to the whole idea of just helping people out and providing. It's almost like it's a free service, but it is like hiring a safety consultant to just come out there and tell you what to do, and working with you is how to improve it. And then they'll come back, so they'll do an inspection or examination, they call it something, and then you come back in a few weeks and check out, make sure you've finished it up.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just one other thing, and I want to thank John. I've worked with him on a couple of issues in my district and so forth, and I do appreciate the cooperation that we've had up there. It's been extremely helpful and very well received by some of my constituents. And then just to follow up just a little bit, you talked about companies that have safety specialists and so forth that are employed by them.
Yeah.
Do you find that affects their work comp rates and so forth? I mean, are you able to lower, are there things that you're able to do within your working model so that you can get your work comp rates lowered?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, yeah, there's no question that it sort of depends on the size of your firm whether you can afford to have a safety person. But boy, if you have a safety person on hand, you really do save money. That someone just go around and helps you every day. And I tour a lot of plants and other work sites, and you can really tell the difference in these firms that emphasize safety. They have signs up and that sort of thing. But there's also a real devotion to detail and looking at things and making sure that things are done properly. I think and they do drop their rates considerably. The workers' comp becomes less of a problem for them. I'm not going to say that no one likes to pay insurance rates. No one likes to do that, but they can drop it a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Appreciate Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
And I am going to call up Doreen Ross. Before I do that, I want to forewarn the members of this committee who are not chairs that don't be surprised if I wander by and hand you the gavel and say run the committee for a while. And we'll try to make sure that the photographer is around too. But I do think that part of the job of a chair is to get other members ready to hold a gavel. So you might want to
Pay attention. Pay attention.
Class number six. Six.
Good afternoon. I think this is the I'll ask you to identify yourself for the record, but the executive director of the Board of Accountancy, Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Survey. You've got a hell of a long title. If you would please identify yourself for the tape and this little background on your particular agency, board.
Chairman Mahoney, members of the committee, again, my name is Doreen Frost. I have two standalone boards, so I'll be testifying separately for each agency due to budget cuts a few years ago. The first one I'm going to be testifying about is the Board of Accountancy, and with me today is Sharon Jensen. She's one of the board members on our nine-member board, and she's a certified public accountant. This agency, I'm going to have you just shift your hat just dramatically. It's not a department. It's a small agency. We have nine board members that are charged with overseeing and establishing policy for the board. And we are, and then we have staff of 3.75, and we handle the day-to-day operations. Minnesota Statute 326A involves the Board of Accountancy, and we're charged with regulating the practice of public accountancy as well as registered accountancy practitioners. The board really approaches their activities from a very thoughtful and passionate perspective. We do have three public members on our board that can have no direct financial interest with any of the professions that regulate, and they provide that balance so that we always have the public interest at heart, and that's really where we operate from. We currently have 17,362 licensed certified public accountants that are either in an active or inactive status. Inactive status does not require them to maintain continuing education, and it's a bargain at $10 a year. And we also license 1,800 plus firms in addition to that. We accomplish our mission really on almost a three or a four-prong approach. First is the examination process. The board no longer handles the exam administration. It's done computerized test. They have four exams that they have to take in addition to an ethics component for all CPAs prior to applying for licensure. So the board does evaluate applications for the after they've completed the exam, but they also spend a lot of time looking at qualifying experience, which is the second element. So they have to have the education standard, they have to pass the national exams, and then they have the experience requirement, and that's where the rubber hits the road for a lot of the board members to have to look at those application files to make sure that the experience is qualified in the area of public accounting. We also have another element, and that's where we really are leaders both in a, on a national level, is Minnesota has a really strong enforcement program. They consider enforcement two prongs. One is the education aspect, making sure that the public knows that there's someplace to go to file a complaint when they're involved in public accountancy. But we also have a peer review process that's involved for the firms that are doing attestation work and financial statements. And we also have a strong enforcement program in the sense of we've handled a high number of complaints. We have complaint orders that have been used as a national standard. And our board was really instrumental in providing a lot of input into an enforcement manual that's now distributed through the National Association of State Board of Accountancies as kind of some guidelines for best practices. We handled 696 complaints in the last biennium, so it's a high volume. A lot of those, quite frankly, don't have foundation. When the economy goes bad or when people run into financial troubles, a lot of times they are looking for someone to blame, and a lot of times complaints with no merit get filed against CPAs. So I don't want to leave you with the impression that under those 696, all of those resulted in enforcement action. We also spend a lot of time on continuing education, both assuring that the 120 hours are in areas that make a difference to the world of public accounting. The CPAs have to have, in addition to 120 every 3 years, they have to have a component of 8 hours of ethics, and they have a rolling clock as to the continuing education process. So continuing education and the audit process that the staff goes through in administering that program also takes a fair amount of our time. The biggest area that the board is looking at and has looked at in the last year has to deal with the fact that mobility came across, which is a good thing for the CPAs, both in this state and other states, and it was passed by you, the legislative arena, I believe in 2004 or 2005, it went into effect in 2005, which allows CPAs that have substantially equivalent requirements in a neighboring state or across the country, with the exception of, I believe, Hawaii, where they can come in and practice without having to pay any additional licensing fees or meet any other standards, as long as they are not permanently located here and that they are not, again, doing financial statements or attestation work. So the board in the last, we've been around since 1909, so a long time. We will be coming before this before this committee later on this session to talk about some raise of some licensing fees. In 1909, the licensing fees were $25 a year, and today they're $45 a year, and we have a staff of 3.5. The chairman, Representative Mahoney, asked me not to go into any details because you will be getting that bill before you, but I do want to let you know that it's coming up. In fiscal year 11, we raised $794,000 went into the general fund, and appropriated back to us was $505,000. In fiscal year fiscal year 12, we generated $940,000 plus in licensing fees, and again appropriated back to us with the budget cut was $480,000. So we do not draw from the general fund. Our licensing fees under 214 have to be neutral, and we generate money into the general fund and then request the fees back on appropriations. I have nothing else to say unless Ms. Jensen would like to add something. Otherwise, I will sit for questions.
Anybody got any question? Thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Maybe the chairman has a question here. I know we're having a hard time coming up with a question, Mr. Chair. These fine testifiers. So. I understand we're going to be getting some more information here from them later.
Yeah, I think you have a bill coming up later this year that will be relatively significant. So hopefully everybody listened.
Chairman Mahoney, members of the committee, yes, I just briefly touched on it and said that we would be bringing it back, but it does have a fee component, and then also to bring the Accountancy Act in compliance with the changes that were made to the Uniform Accountancy Act across the country.
No questions. We want to go to the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Survey, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design.
Yes.
Which one do you want to cover first?
Chairman Mahoney, members of the committee, I have had the, again, I'm Doreen Frost. I'm the executive director of that licensing board as well. I've been with that board since 1996, and I picked up the Board of Accountancy in 2005. I'm sorry to say my chairman is currently out ill, so she is unable to join me. Let me just tell you, this is a very interesting board. It's unique in the fact that it has 21 board members. Five are public members, and it's interesting from the perspective of, although they are all under one board, as you'll see in the brochure that I distributed, they are distinct, separately different professions. We have 21 board members and five in the public, and we have seven staff currently, or actually 6.5. I'm 0.5 to that agency. This board, a lot of the staff time, we still administer the exams. They are not computer-based tests, with the exception of architecture and landscape architecture. So the staff still does administer the exams across the state. We are in the process. So the National Council is moving for an electronic-based test for electrical engineers, although electrical engineers are part of our board. But what I meant to say was for the fundamentals of engineering, we'll be going to a computer-based test. So we're in the process of rewriting our rules, and we'll have some changes that will come before the legislative arena as these tests become computerized. But the staff is involved in the day-to-day operations in administering the examinations as well as reviewing the files. Again, similar, and I won't repeat all of the things, it's very similar to the accountancy board in the sense that we are charged with enforcing 326 as it relates to making sure that the licensees are competent and that they remain current. We do that through the education, the exam, and the experience, and again, our board members are heavily involved in reviewing progressive experience in order to obtain that license. Each national exam has a different licensing entity on a national level that writes the national exams, with the exception of the land surveying exam. Each state, because of the geographic conditions, typically has a local land surveying exam that they also administer. So we write locally the land surveying exam, in addition to the fact that the land surveyors have to take two national exams. We generate, again, our licensing fees come to the general fund, and we ask for the appropriations back out of them. We do our renewals every 2 years for these seven professions. So in fiscal year 11, we generated $679,000 in licensing fees, and we were appropriated back $815,000 in licensing fees. Before that gets you wrapped around the axle, I want you to know it's because it's right on the renewal cycle. And in fiscal year 12, we generated $2,081,000 in licensing fees, and we're generated back $774,000. $1,000 in licensing fees. We don't have as high a number of complaints for these regulated professions. We had 171 complaints in the last fiscal year. They tend to be more complex, involving multiple discipline and standards of care that are different in the built environment. And we also have a high number of applicants that come from other countries, and we have had several hearings at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and one case this last fiscal year that ended up at the Court of Appeals on denial of an application for lacking the educational requirements that are part of our requirements under state law. So although they're similar as far as the standards that are out there to protect the public, these two licensing boards, I want to assure you, are separate. They have separate budgets. They share mutual office space. We were lean before lean was popular. They eliminated duplications of equipment. They eliminated staffing. We do cross-reference on staffing. That's been allowed under the legislative audit. And you reduced and saved money by reducing both staff and taking two executive directors and making it one position. This board serves on a lot of national committees again, has been a real leader in the enforcement and the regulation and the establishing of standards for these seven professions. Mr. Chair, I have nothing else.
Are there any questions? Representative Norton.
Thank you. I was curious, you mentioned particularly, I think it was land developers.
Land surveyors.
Land surveyors that you said took two national exams as well as a local. Can you tell me, with that area and with other areas, convince me of the need for that? Could you, are there people that pass the other two and fail our local one? Do generally people pass all of them? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative, I couldn't see your name.
Sorry.
Representative Norton, my apologies for not knowing you. And members of the committees, you need all three. Land surveyors are establishing boundaries. In a state with a high number of lakes, there's called lost boundaries, and there's a lot of complications for each geographical area in the country. There are different standards as well from the East Coast to the West Coast on some of it. But absolutely, there's no very little crossover between the national exams and the state local exam. Land surveyors are a little bit different in the sense that each state has case law. And in the land surveying world, they need to not only know how to establish the boundaries, but they have to be familiar with the case law on disputes. And that case disputes, and that case law tends to be specific to a state. So on the local land surveying exam, they have to not only know our Minnesota statutes and rules, but part of the training they get in their educational background is on a lot of case law that's required when they're actually preparing their drafts prior to submittal to the to the permitting agencies. So it is really distinctly different than a state that doesn't have, you know, 10,000 lakes, and it also really has a lot to do with the case law for each state. So it is not uncommon for a land surveyor to come in from Wisconsin or any of the surrounding states. They've already been licensed in that other jurisdiction, and they've already passed those two exams, but they will have to take the Minnesota local, just like they would have to take the Minnesota, Wisconsin, or the North Dakota exam.
Representative Fabian, would you have another question? Yes, Mr. Chair. It's kind of more of a philosophical question for the chair and the committee. With the past $2, if they're generating substantial amount of income and they're talking about a fee increase, I'm not exactly sure why we would need to do that, but.
Correct me if I'm wrong, two separate boards. The Board of Accountancy is paying for a fee increase, not the Board of all the alphabets, correct?
Yeah. Chairman Mahoney and members of the committee, yes. One is, it has a lot of extra fees as we went through budget cuts. We kept getting cut and more money went into the general fund. Board of Accountancy does not have the same number of surplus that's being carried over. And although we do carry excess, it's not significant enough to support the staff increases that we'll be coming back and asking for.
And before I call on Representative Metza, I would ask that you touch base with both House Republican and DFL staff, kind of explain what your fee increase is for the Board of Accountancy, because if I remember right, it's close to 50% increase, something like that.
Yes, sir.
But those would be the people so that they could get out to the rest of us initial questions for when you come back.
I'd be more than happy to do so, sir.
Representative Metza, is your question?
I can take it offline. Thank you. It's semi-answered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking through this, I can kind of see why you need licensing for some of these things, but I'm looking at interior design. Is this an optional thing for interior designers in order to get certain work or just be able to put certified in front of their name?
Chairman Mahoney and Representative Kiefer and members of the committee, the first professions, with the exception of certified interior designers, are called what's called a practice and a title act, and that's similar with the accountants as well. You cannot either use the title or practice any of those professions without a license. Certified interior designers, it is a title act only, although anytime you pass a title act, you kind of have to define what that is in statute. But we do not regulate the practice of certified interior designers unless they cross over into the world of architecture. And that was a negotiation that took place at the legislative arena a long time ago. So we only regulate the title certified interior designer, and we do not get involved in the practice thereof unless they cross over into the world of architecture or something else.
Thank you.
Can I follow up with this particular question? What's the cost of the registration or license for the interior design professional?
Well, Chairman Mahoney and members of the committee, it's very interesting. In that negotiation, all architects can apply and be a certified interior designer, which, by the way, comes in some of the contracts for the state. Certified interior designers are dealing with flame-retardant finishes. They're dealing in public spaces as well. In the world of cubicles and in exit patterns, you know, we hear interior design and we think of the Home Depot or my, I was going to say home decorator, but I don't have one. But we think of residential and we think of the areas that are not in the public spaces. Let me be very clear. The certified interior designers are in public spaces. When we entered into the world of cubicles, you still have exit patterns. If you know the history of cubicles, they were meant to be a temporary fixture for a one-time fix that became very popular. Now you look at the Department of Commerce, which is upstairs with me or in my office, you have a large number of people potentially in the world of cubicle spaces that you have to deal with safety issues as it relates to flame retardants. They're non-load-bearing walls, It's fabrics and finishes that have to, and exit patterns to the exits that go outside the buildings. So there is a component to the protection of the public health, safety, and welfare, which is why they were placed on the licensing board. I say that because architects don't have to go through the same standards. Certified interior designers have a national exam that they have to complete. There are schools in the state of Minnesota that are four-year programs that offer that so that they can take the national certification for interior design qualification exam. They have to have public planning that goes into effect of all of this. Now, they pay the same licensing fee. If you just hung on, I would get back to it. They pay a certification fee, and it is $120. Architects pay $120 as well, with the exception of the application fee. Architects pay $50. Certified interior designers, on an error in the legislation that was passed, they have no application fee for the evaluation process through the state of Minnesota.
You asked my question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other questions?
Yeah, unless we
Mr. Chair, maybe I just missed it. Does that mean that a person can operate as an interior designer without certification?
Ms. Frost.
I was afraid to answer without being called on. Representative Chairman Mahoney and Representative
Isaacson, you're good.
Thank you. There's two different things, two areas of practice. Yes, there are interior designers throughout the state and throughout the country that are not certified. And they cannot use the title CID. Those tend to be single-family residences, and they have other qualifications and other exams that they take, but they don't hold a certification in the state of Minnesota. They may hold a professional association like ASID or IIDA, which is in the bath and kitchen kind of area, and you will see those in publications and magazines, and they tend to be through businesses that are doing single-family residences. Okay. But yes, you may call yourself an interior designer in the state without being a certified interior designer.
Interesting. Thank you.
So notice that why I kind of stepped back, because I was here for the fight between the architects, the interior designers, and the others. And it was one of those times that you kind of wanted to hide behind one of the pillars. So I think, there was another question, Representative Metzen.
It's just a suggestion for Representative Isaacson, thank you, Mr. Chair, to check out Love It or List It. They have a good variety of architecture that does not involve or interior design.
With that, thank you so very much. We appreciate it. Members, there's no more business before the committee. I will tell you that on the next meeting, is Thursday the 17th, we will have a presentation by the Rural Finance Authority, something new to our committee. I don't think it's going to take up the whole hour and a half or all 45 minutes, but hopefully you'll get here on time and have some thoughts and questions about this, because this is something that I've never seen very well. Economic development having some fingers into the egg community, which is a good thing, because you want to keep the citizens and small towns of Minnesota all vibrant. Thank you all.